This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hey, everyone. This is the Two Guys from Hollywood podcast, a Spotify and Villa Romana network production. I'm Alan Nevitz.
And I'm Joey Sand.
Hi, Joey.
Hello, Alan.
There's a lot going on this week.
Yes, there are.
So we need to jump into this because there's a lot to talk about. And then we need to introduce our very interesting guests today because we're going to set it up before they come on so that our listeners know who they are and what they are so that when the interview starts, they're already clued in and we don't have to waste time with these ladies figuring out who they are.
Yeah, because you really can't really tell until... till we get rolling, what it's all about.
Right. Well, we did that intentionally because they yes. had limited time. They were calling in from all over the world, actually. And so we promised to keep it brief.
Brief, but then we also want to be very specific on what we're talking about. So
brief,
what
but then we kept them on 20 minutes longer than we
than
promised.
Than we intended to. True.
You want to bring up a new thing. You want to introduce a new segment, which I rather approve of.
Yes, well, it's new. It will be new as a segment, yes.
Yeah.
But Philip and
it's
I, and
you're not,
and you know, I use this expression
yes.
all the time, and so I'll just give you a quick little history on it. So when we were going to school, Philip and I, we had a couple of there was a couple of girls that we met in school that were they were two sisters and they were black girls, and so their expression when something was a little bit cringeworthy. Yeah. Was like, oh, that is stink. That is so
I
stink.
I love that.
You know, the expression. So we picked it up way back when we were kids. And
right.
we've been using it all this time. And so it's almost like a little bit addicting because now all of our friends know, and for years and years know what it is and use it for their own thing. Like even my mother picked it up. She'd say, oh, that is so stink, Joey. Please don't say that again. You know, so it just became that thing. You say it. So all
right.
our friends say it. Even some of my clients say it. So it is an expression that we use when something is rather cringeworthy. Something that either someone does or it could be a performance. It could be an attitude. It could be a book. It could be a movie. It could be just an expression.
How somebody behaves.
Yeah, or just an expression is just a commentary on something that is just rather cringeworthy.
Okay, so great. Well, we got saying, lots of those things.
Yeah, and I'm sure we all go through it. So rather than saying, oh, that is so cringeworthy, which is about as...
right.
white as you can get, we say, ooh, that is stink.
All right, so we're doing what, a stink
so
list?
So we're going to have a stink list every week.
Okay.
So what you, some things that you think are stink or cringe.
Well, you know me, I think a lot of things are stink.
Exactly. And
but...
I, you know, I can't get stink enough. You know what I mean? So so you can start with your, let's give a couple on your stink list.
Okay, well, my stink list, I guess, would be, did you see this... what do they call it? A smash and grab or whatever that happened at Nordstrom's in Canoga Park the other day,
yeah, well,
which
is
just
one
over
of
the
how
hill.
Many?
Well, it is.
The latest.
But the video is really a little disturbing.
It is.
And
they get bigger and bigger.
Yeah. I mean, this was like 30 to yeah. 40 people uh-huh. dressed in black with masks rushing in to Nordstrom's at the, you know, during their regular business operating hours while customers and guests are there.
Can I ask you,
yeah.
just before you go on, is this Nordstrom or Nordstrom Rack?
Nordstrom.
Okay, so
it's in the mall in Canoga Park.
So they moved up from Dress for Less and all that.
Yes. This is Nordstrom, which is not cheap anymore.
No, but...
and it's in the Canoga Park Mall. And they so they rushed in. They weren't happy enough just taking merchandise, which was estimated at almost $100,000 worth of merchandise. But they then, you know, had to smash the shelves and tear down things in Nordstrom's and make a whole sort of thing out of it.
I heard they molested the mannequins. That's how bad it's getting.
Well, the mannequins liked it,
yeah.
but they hadn't been touched quite like that. No, but it was really, it's worth going online and looking up the video. It's rather disturbing. And they, you know, and this is happening all the time now.
It's a trend.
It's a trend. Nobody's getting prosecuted for it. You know, the new laws in California, and I'm going to go with it because you know me, I'm not an ultra liberal. I'm not built that way.
Listen, you can't even
I'm a moderate
without somebody coming at you.
No, exactly.
You know.
And you know, they all, you know, they changed the law that now if you take less than $900 from a place, you can't even call the cops. But you know, $900 to
a lot of money,
especially to a family-owned business, $900 of merchandise is a lot. Now Nordstrom's is $100,000, and I'm sure they have insurance and they'll collect on the insurance. But by the way, all that does is make insurance rates higher because someone is going to pay for this down the road. I don't know what we're going to do about it, but we got to tighten the laws. And I know nobody wants to pay taxes to keep people in jail, and they don't want to do all these things, and they're going to let them out, and we don't have bail anymore. Let me tell you, all I know, it ain't working.
No.
It's not working. And there's going to be a backlash, like in a lot of other states, and suddenly you're going to see the Democrats not acting quite so Democrat-y. They're going to be like, throw them in jail.
Well,
because you know, you and I, we're Democrats. We don't approve of this behavior. We certainly think they should be prosecuted.
It's not a political thing. This is a crime.
But it is because...
But it's a crime.
It's a crime, but the Democrats put through the law that allowed this to happen. And
it's not
again...
It's Democrats. It's a Democrat.
Liberal Democrats.
A liberal.
Far left.
With the bleeding hearts. I can't deal with that.
Right. And it's the same problem on the right. We both have the same problem. You know, this country is about the middle 70%, not the fringe 15 on both ends, which have taken over control. Okay, but they're all stink.
Very stink. You got it? Now you see, can you understand how stink works?
Stink. Okay, what's your stinky thing?
My stinky thing is, okay, it's now please don't be mad at me for this. And I do like her.
Me
and I like
or what, the audience?
The audience.
Okay.
And I like her, and I like her music, and I like what she brings to the entire thing.
Who are we talking about?
Taylor Swift.
Oh,
and it's not
Swiftie.
Her. It's the people, some of the people that are fans of hers that are Swifties.
Right.
And so to me, that is
stink.
A little bit stink.
Right.
So when
because of the way they act, you mean?
Yeah. It's like, you know, listen, I get the young girls and boys and they you know, they have that, you know, and they're fans and they should be. And that's, you know, and that's
right.
That's the
like
whole
we all did
all
growing
that.
Up.
We all did it. And yeah. We still do it to some degree. But when you've got, you know, I mean, I was just the other day at shopping and there was a woman you know, right behind me, and she was talking to the sales girl about, oh, I'm so excited. She's going to the Swiftie concert or you know, the Taylor Swift concert, and she was buying all these things to wear, and she had these beads and things, and she has...
How old was she?
Like 58. You know, okay, and that's... Love, you don't want to tell somebody they can't be somebody or something.
Right.
You know, they don't have to go to a, you know, a Wayne Newton concert.
Right.
You know, but for God's sakes, it's a little bit stink. And not that you shouldn't have fun and do all that stuff, but it's a little bit stink. And you're not going to tell me that their daughter or son that sees mom's going to a Swiftie concert with eight of her friends dressed like, you know, with candy beads and all this stuff.
Right.
Doesn't think that that's a little bit stink.
Right.
So.
And not wanting to go with them.
Right,
We'll go on another day, Mom.
Yeah, okay. So it's just, so that just has a tinge of stink to me. But no difference than there's a tinge of stink with the Beyonce concert, too. That everybody's dressing like Beyonce in sexy outfits.
But that's always happened. Have you gone to a Stevie Nicks concert? They're all in boots and lace.
It's all stink. So I'm just using this particular one that reignited that stink in me.
Right, okay.
Got
right.
Me?
It's
the
stink,
same thing.
It's stink across
yeah,
the rock.
Yeah, it's like going to, you know, Woodstock.
Woodstink.
That was kind of stink, too. Shit, there was
it stunk of a lot of pot. What it stank of
and,
is pot.
You know, and hairy armpits.
And LSD. That's what it stank of.
And gladiator sandals. You know, that's brutal. Or those Schlieven Schlavens. What do they call those sandals that are Schlieven Schlavens?
I have no idea. Schliebenschlaven.
Birkenstocks. Yeah. Birkenschlaven, something like that.
Schliebenschlaven.
This is the worst looking Birkenstocks.
Oh, they're the worst. They're the worst.
Worst. But that comes with granola and, you know, bugle beads and all that stuff.
Because they're not into fashion. They're into their Birkenstocks.
But it's a fashion of its own.
Yeah, you know, no, it's anti-fashion.
You know, pre-Raphaelite dresses and Birkenstocks. Help me. Now that is stink too. So does everyone listening to this get what stink is? Start using it.
Okay. Moving on. We've stunk enough.
Stinks in here.
Do we have anything good to say today? Did you see anything good, or have you read anything good, or have you watched anything good that we should?
It was interesting. There was a documentary, and it was about a serial killer, a gay serial killer. Did I tell you about it? It's on HBO Max.
No, but I would watch that probably. Serial killers.
It was only four episodes,
uh-huh.
And it took place in New York,
uh-huh.
And it started in the in the late.
Of course, he had to be gay.
Well, if he was gay, then he'd still be having fun. He wasn't gay. He was a tormented person that wasn't accepted by the gay community and had a vengeance toward because he wanted to be.
Right.
And couldn't pull it off. You know, when you're not that attractive, it gets really hard.
Hello, Jeffrey Dahmer.
Do you know what I mean?
So yeah.
It's
no,
rough on some wannabe queens. It really is a tough sell.
Yeah.
You know? So they have that resentment, and then, you know, they weren't loved by their family. They were probably from the South or someplace like that had all that religious stuff attached.
Right. And it was on HBO, you say?
HBO Max.
Uh-huh. Gay serial killer.
Yeah, it was called, Last Call.
Oh.
Yeah, Last Call. So it was an interesting title because it, you know, he would pick up these people in a bar, in a gay bar.
Right.
But here's
when they were desperate, they're most desperate in the Last Call.
Yeah, that 11 o'clock cute, that's scary.
More like 1 a.m.
1 a.m. cute. Sorry, yeah, 3-hour time difference in New York. The interesting thing was, and it was also a little bit scary, watching it, because the three of the murders and victims he met at the townhouse.
Oh.
In New York. On the
a lot of
side.
The people in there are already dead. They just don't know it.
But that's where we hang out there. We hang out there in New York.
No, we.
Yes. So, Alan, don't say that. You always go with me
in New York. I hate that place.
But you go there.
I go there because you're there.
No,
but I hate that
place. I've been
place.
Going there forever because it is a gentleman's club. It's up club. It's upscale. And it has a nice crowd.
Yes, upscale. I mean, the crowd is 70 and above.
Well, it's better than that. Anyway. You know, you just killed it.
Oh, I have some interesting news to
to
relay.
Please share.
I am the proud owner of a pilot's license.
Fantastic. I am so proud of you. That is amazing. And
I'm so excited. I don't know what I'm going to do with it now that I have it. Because now you have to sort of fly, and you have to get a plane, or you have to rent a plane. You have to, like, plan your life now around flying.
Which we do have a couple. But yes. We don't know how to fly those kind of planes.
But I had taken the major part of the test a few weeks back.
Yeah.
And we sort of had a little interruption. And so I had to do one little piece with the examiner again. So he said, can you meet me? He's a commercial pilot. And he said, can you meet me in Santa Monica on Sunday? And we just need to do one lap around the airport. And as long as you don't mess that up, you'll get your pilot's license. And I was like, sure. And the crazy thing is, and I told him, I said, it's kind of crazy because I flew from Van Nuys over the mountain, you know, over the hills to Santa Monica, landed. I did two more laps at the airport there and did full stops, returned, took off because I wanted to make sure I could do this properly with him. And the funny thing is that when he got on the plane, I said, you know, it's a little weird that they allowed me to fly over here by myself, do two laps around the airport, and now I have to do a lap with you to make sure it's okay for me to fly.
Right.
And he laughed. He said, I know, it's a little silly. But, you know, he had to do it because those are the rules. We got on the plane. I did my first lap. And as we were, you know, they had me squeezed in between two planes. And so as I'm landing, you know, I thought, oh, that plane is a little close, right? And he said, wait, and the examiner kept saying, wait, he's going to clear the runway in time. Just keep going, just keep landing. Because he also, he doesn't live here, and he had to make a helicopter ride, apparently. So he was trying to get out of there, too.
Right.
And, of course, the tower came on and said, oh, we need you to go around. I knew what he was thinking. He was thinking, oh, crap. I was thinking, oh, crap, too, because I thought, oh, my God, now I have to do another lap with the right. examiner in the plane. What if I screw up something?
Yeah.
But it all went well. We landed. All was good. And he handed me my pilot's
license. That's fantastic. Congratulations.
So I'm very happy.
I'm very happy for you.
Anyway, so that's exciting. All right, should we jump into introducing who our guests are?
Yeah, let's explain to our audience a little bit so they...
Yeah, so there was a group of women in the 70s, and they were all related to the adult porn industry. They were all appearing in porn films. And they all had an interesting perspective on it. And by the way, all of them, these are very bright women. This is not the women you think of in porn films, you know, trashy.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Yeah. I see you've done
yeah.
porn.
Oh, yeah. In the Philippines. I mean, come on.
You know, they're all very, very bright, and some of the audience will recognize them. I mean, they all excelled at other things. There were five women in this group. Unfortunately, two of them have already died. Gloria died, and the other one is Candida Royale. So joining us today, we have three ladies. We have Robin Leonardi, who is the daughter of Gloria Leonard. And there's a whole reason the names don't match. We won't go there. And we also have Jane Hamilton. She's better known as Veronica Hart. And then we have Veronica Vera, who you will hear us refer to as V. Group of women, they got together. They created a group called Club 90. It was kind of a therapy group, basically. It was for them to get together and talk about their problems, the things that they were facing as porn stars and porn film workers. And it allowed them a little bit of an outlet so that they didn't feel like, oh, am I the only person? As we do today. We didn't do that then, right? Today,
there was a camaraderie between them.
Yeah, people get together and realize other people have the same problems that they do.
Camaraderie.
And so this Club 90 is a lot of them talking about what was going on at that time. Mm-hmm. Feminism, women's rights. They were being paid less than the men. Interesting thing that we don't talk about in this interview is if they were told that they were going to have sex with another woman, they weren't going to get paid because that wasn't sex. And so they had to be having sex with a man in order to get paid. If they were told, oh, we're doing this shoot and you're going to be, woman and woman, but we're not
That's
paying
you
because it's not, yeah. It's
What's
not,
that, practice?
Yeah, it's not sex, right? So there was a lot of injustices, right?
We don't pay you for rehearsal.
Yes, exactly. So when we come back from commercial, we will have Club 90. Well, welcome, ladies. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Y'all look lovely. It's good to see you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for allowing us the opportunity.
Each of our podcasts, Joey, who's a celebrity chef, creates a drink for our guests. And he's created something for you today. And I'm going to let him talk about that.
Yes, unfortunately, you can't enjoy it with us. And I know it's very hot where you are, Robin, and it's probably pretty warm where you guys are, too, but it's very hot for us. So I created a cocktail, and it has fresh passion fruit, which I float on the top, and pineapple juice, vanilla vodka, and a little bit of passion fruit juice, and a lot of ice. And it's called the Porn Star. That's why it's in a very large glass.
Can I have a tequila version of that?
The what?
Vodka and I just don't get along very well. Can I have the tequila version of that?
Oh, yeah. You can improvise. I'll send you, the recipe will be sent to you guys, and then you can improvise it how you want. But this
I
is
bet
the
rum would be good with that.
Rum too would be great. Anything would be good in it. Yeah. Well, cheers, salud.
L'chaim.
L'chaim.
Salud.
It is good. It's quite good.
It is good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, so that's not. Wait just a second. Now I'm going to go grab my beer. Cheers. How are you?
There you go.
You don't have to be a porn star to drink this, but you'll perform like one after a couple of them.
Wow. Oh, okay. Put a label on that one.
With then. Any luck.
Hanging from the chandeliers.
That's right.
Woo! Woo!
So my first question for you is to explain, Robin, you were not technically a Club 90 member. I think you're more of an honorary member, correct?
I'm what they call Club 91, which is actually the children, the offspring of those that were in the adult entertainment industry. And that was kind of, I think, coined by Gerard Damiano Jr. So having been 12, I think, or 13 years old at the time that my mother became an adult film star and consequently met with these lovely ladies, you know, I'll be 60, so it's been a while, and they are like aunties to me and family, and I am honored that I can be included in today's podcast. So,
well, thank you.
Yes, thank you for joining us.
This is the 40-year anniversary, actually, of Club 90 starting, because we were at my son's baby shower. We didn't know it was a son at that time, but my son's baby shower was kind of where it all started. And he just turned 40 this year. Can you believe it, Robin?
Wow.
Wow.
Well, just so everybody understands, this came out of an article that was written for an online magazine called Narratively at narratively.com. And they've done it's a nice long piece. It's 40 pages when you print it out, by the way, about Club 90. And of course, the whole thing reads like it should be a television series. And basically,
you could repeat that.
Truth is stranger than fiction.
You notice how they have the characters already drawn out. Each one, it focuses on each one of us and kind of gives a characterization, you know, summary. So all you producers out there, you better check it out because it's your homework.
Jump on it. We always said we were Sex in the City. Way before Sex in the City. We were the real Sex in the City.
Oversexed in the city.
And proud of it.
Is that a term? Can there be too much sex?
I think we may have just coined that. Oversexed in the city. It's better than undersexed.
Oversexed
anywhere.
In the city?
Yeah. Oversexed. Yeah. It's better than undersexed anywhere.
Yeah. Anyway, I think we're all, I mean, speaking for myself, but I think also for all of us, I mean, this is a great article. Hallie Lieberman did a terrific article.
Yes, indeed.
And it was not easy hurting us cats. Yeah.
There's so many different people and so many different inputs and everything. And it's nice to see it compiled into one place and to get a cohesive, intelligent and truthful accounting of what went down rather than somebody sitting there making up what they think porn stars do or what they might talk about or what they might be like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which was the whole purpose in forming Club 90 40 years ago. So people could really understand what we were about.
No, we started Club 90 to understand what we were about, B. We didn't care what you guys thought about us back then at all. It was all about us. We've been a support
and it's a continuing process.
Yeah.
And there's some great photos in the article of all of you when you were young. But basically, it was this group of women working in the sex industry, and they decided to get together so that they could talk amongst themselves, basically, about what was going on in their lives. And the rule was it couldn't be shared with anybody, including husbands and boyfriends, correct?
Correct, yes.
How'd that work out?
Mm-hmm. When you live with people and you're Zooming and things like that, things get shared just because you're talking and, you know, your spouse walks through in the background. Right, Stan? Stan's over here right now, so he's... He really, I have a small place, so he can't go any, He's waving. He's waving to you. So, you know, when we were in person, that was different. Sometimes it's a little different to confine your Zoom spaces. I know Annie, who's not with us here today, she's busy with her wife in, I think they're in Germany now.
In Berlin. Right?
Berlin. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess probably. Well, yeah, just.
Are they finishing up in Salzburg and then Monday they're going to?
They just had an opening. They had an opening for a gallery show in Austria last night. So I guess they'll be traveling either today or tomorrow to Germany.
And she's become quite a well-known artist, correct?
Yes, internationally known performance artist, along with her wife, Beth.
She's amazing.
Beth is a professor of art at UC Santa Cruz, Annie's wife. And so they travel, and they've been doing performance art for 20 years, and their stuff has just always been very cutting edge, revolutionary.
Oh, interesting.
Annie's always been a revolutionary, so I just want to get that off
Doesn't she,
of the
though?
Record.
And then when we first started with Club 90, that was one of the reasons we started, because Annie was having a profession, not a crisis, but a turning point in the roads. And she was thinking, you know, do I want to stay with pornography or should I become an artist or a photographer? And that was one of the things that we met about back then.
Well, yeah. I love the quote that she says, after having sex with 3,500 men, she decided she needed a change. And now, of course, she's been with a woman.
She's had a few changes since then. Male to female to male to female, and now a lesbian.
Beth is the perfect fit. Beth Stevens is a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful person.
Those were quote-unquote sex changes.
No, partners.
No, I'm kidding. I know.
She made a cutting edge movie. God, I don't know, maybe 30 years ago. Remember, it was Les to Linda. Do you remember that?
It was Linda, Les, and Annie. Yeah, the first transsexual love story.
And it was, I think, their relationship both pre and post op.
Very interesting.
This was this was back in the day, dude.
Yeah,
payphones on the street corner days.
Right.
Annie always led us. I mean, you know, she was the first one that was really heavy into tantra sex, you know, moving energy and everything through sexuality. And boy, yeah. I had done it when I was younger, actually with Stan over there. And I didn't know that that's what I had done. But I know that I was always looking for it again after that, because it was pretty amazing and rocked my little world. And so she was heavily into that. She was a photographer. She was artist. She was performance artist. She's an amazing woman. She is, not was, is.
You wanted to be an actress.
I am an actress. Excuse me.
You wanted to be a different kind of actress.
I don't want to be an actress. I am an actress. I do act.
but that's not by faking orgasms, right? No.
You know, I guess when the director said, come now, I guess probably that was pretty fake. But if
then you'd be a method actress at that point. Yeah.
Right. You know, hey, I played Susie in Wait Until Dark and I did not poke my eyes out. Okay. What?
I worked with
Paul Thomas
movie.
Anderson. Yeah, well, Paul Thomas Anderson used me in a couple of films. Boogie Nights, I played the custody judge. And unfortunately, my face on screen, the names in the credit was longer than my face was on screen for in Magnolia. But he was very kind and he used me.
But those were later. But when you were originally, according to this, it said when they originally asked you to be an adult movie, she said, no, I'm an actress.
Right. I had a degree in theater then. You know, I had a BA from UNLV. And we played at the Kennedy Center, the Eisenhower Theater, for a college thing that we'd won. I played Adela and the House of Bernarda Alba. Let's see, I'd been to Australia.
Right. Do you ever look back and wonder if things would have gone differently if you had not done the porn movies and you had tried to stay with sort of the Hollywood movies? Do you ever regret
it?
I guess is the question.
There was no acting in it. And it was like, well, that's fun, but that's certainly not what I want to do. But then when I went and I saw the big screen and you know, there was acting before they took off their clothes. And I thought, God, sex and acting and getting paid for it. Woo, you know? So I'd say it's impacted my children differently. Probably one son benefited from the fact that I was an adult. We were teaching in China. And as a matter of fact, he just married his girlfriend in China. And I'm going to be joining mm-hmm. them for a month in September. They just got married before Christmas. So that hasn't impacted Max badly. But I don't think me being in the adult business has been my other son's favorite choice.
Yeah, well, you know, anything that has to do with show business, or and it is show business, children always have some sort of, it's either affects them well or affects them not so well. It's just a personal thing. Just as a footnote, and I don't know if you even remember any of this stuff, but or know who this is, Joseph Sarno is my uncle.
Cool.
And he was one of the very first, he's an American film director and screenwriter. And he started in the 50s and 60s with pornography. He's written and directed, produced over 75 films, Inga being one of them in the 60s, and all throughout the 60s, all the way until his death in the late 90s. So very interesting how that's...
I believe he directed All About Gloria Leonard.
I believe he did too. I did, yeah. So
Joe,
yeah.
Joe was a great guy. Everyone that ever knew Joe loved him. And that's kind of how I met Perry, was through Joe. But there was a great documentary about Joe.
Yeah, it was called, I'm trying to remember the name of it.
My Life in Dirty Pictures.
My Life in Dirty. And you know, the funny thing was, I was flying home from Europe, my partner and I, and we're on the plane, and I had just gone through a couple of movies already. And then all of a sudden I saw on the list that film, and I wait, that's my uncle, and I watched it, and I was on the plane. The film was on the plane. It was crazy. Anyway, I watched it. It was fantastic, and I immediately called his widow Peggy and told her how much I enjoyed it, you know, because it was a lot about her too and their relationship and all of that. So it was a great documentary.
What I took away from that was, you know, he was making those sexploitation films,
right,
where there was a lot of innuendo and a lot of passion and a lot of heavy petting, and they really didn't cut to the gynecological
exam. No, not till later, much later.
Not until later, and it was hard for him to make that change.
It was.
He felt that romance, what wasn't seen, was what was the
what was sexy.
On.
Yeah, because like it was very art cuties film for him. No,
no,
you know, it was about that.
It
wasn't even
after
soft
that,
porn yet.
Soft
porn even came later.
Was actually the genre,
you know, when
he
was starting, was in the 50s
create,
and then early 60s. And then
yes.
But yeah, so that
earlier,
was a transition,
so
that he wasn't.
Yeah,
they had tributes for him
in
the Underground Film Festival, Torino Film Festival in Italy.
I think they showed that film at the Anthology Film Archives.
Yeah.
Here in New York.
Interesting man. Very, very talented and very respected in his field, too. So.
And a sweetheart.
A sweetheart, yeah. I met John Waters recently, and he's an absolute huge fan of my uncle as well. People don't realize, you know, they look at it in such a different way, but it is all an art form. Everything we do, no matter how that is, and probably it's the most honest form of art. I mean, the most real, because it is raw. You know,
exactly.
It is completely,
it is
you know,
real,
when they talk about to be a good actor, you know, it's about being naked. You know, and allowing yourself to be completely free from everything. And so is sex. In order to be good at sex, you have to be completely free of everything. And naked helps.
Well, that's an art hole?
Wow. An art hole.
I'm an art hole.
That's hilarious.
I haven't considered myself that, but that's how we became legalized. Because, no, seriously, not, I guess, by being art holes, they said before that making adult films was a form of prostitution. Okay. So we were, it was illegal and it was against the law. And then Dave Friedman helped in the late 80s, I think 87, overturned that law by saying that this was an artistic endeavor. And they finally passed it because both people, both performers were being paid and there usually was a script. And, you know, so all of a sudden it got passed that it was an artistic endeavor. It was not an act of prostitution. And that's how the adult films began to, you know, progress and be legitimate, be legal. And, you know, people stopped going to jail for them.
That's fascinating.
Well, couldn't you also say that being a wife is a form of prostitution?
Abso-fucking-lutely. Can I say fucking on this show?
Yes.
You can.
I think you did.
You know, I mean, and then listen, I don't think you're getting paid quite as much for all the work that they do as a wife and a mother and everything else. That's a form
and
of
nurse,
too. So,
right?
Yes,
you're a nurse.
Yeah, everything.
Well, there's also a whole movement. There was a movement in the 70s called Wages for Housework, and they were all teamed up with the sex workers' rights movement as well. There's, you know, there's definitely a connection.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I think there's also something to mention here for our younger audience, because you know, now it seems like everybody's a sex star. You turn on your computer and it's everywhere, right?
Yeah, mother, daughter, sister, uncle, grandmother, all together, yeah.
Whereas then, and Jane, by the way, I mean, you became a big porn star. You weren't just sort of one of these, you know, off the cuff. You became a big name in that industry. And at that time, they showed those films in theaters. I mean, Deep Throat ran down the street here for forever.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, it was a different time. It was the time of porno chic. It was the time where X-rated films were shot on 35mm with
sure.
two and three camera, with a wardrobe department and sets and lighting
and dialogue.
And my mother always said, you know, speaking of fucking, was that if, you know, for her to be in a film, that if you were to extract the sex scenes from it, that it would still hold up as a film that had, you know, plot and character development. And that's, I think, what really drew her to wanting to make these films, because they weren't just, you know, ding dong, pizza delivery guy. You know, there was more to it. And once that kind of shifted, predominantly with the advent of home video, once the VCR was introduced into the bedroom, women like Candida, who is not here with us today, but in spirit, you know, she took that to a whole other level, because she was able to then create content for women who before could never really go see an X-rated film unless they wanted to march themselves down to the sleazy theater with the raincoat crowd.
And you'd have to bring an umbrella, believe me.
Right.
Because it was raining inside the theater, I swear.
I'm sure it was.
We sat there, and then all these guys, all the seats filled in right around us. It was amazing. It was like every place else in the theater was empty, but there was like three women. I think it was myself, Mary Jane, and I think it was Mary, and my sister Mary, my niece. And all of a sudden, we had all these guys all around us. You know, it was pretty funny. They were very nice, though. They didn't touch, because we told them not to.
Well, there was a time, I think it was about 14 years old, and Perry was 12. And at that time, my father had done a film with Robert Mitchum. And one of the actors was Stephen Keats, and he and Stephen became very good friends. And Stephen's partner, this woman, Raina Barrett, was an actress, and she and my mother became very good friends. And so Raina had called my mother and said that she was having a screening of her latest film and would she'd like to come. And my mother says, oh, well, I'm with my boys. We're having dinner. We're going out to dinner, and it's in Manhattan. She says, well, come. It's going to be later. It's at 9 or 10 o'clock. She says, okay, then I'll bring my boys. She said, fantastic. They'll love it. It was a screening of a porn film with John Holmes. So it started off as a regular film. Perry and I didn't know. And we're sitting in the theater, and all of a sudden, it starts going into the romantic scene and then the nudity. I can't remember. Yeah, and then all of a sudden, that is our introduction to the largest penis on the planet. And Perry and I started laughing.
On the big screen.
How
old were you?
I was 14 and Perry was 12.
And
then my mother, Oh, it was a private screening in Manhattan.
But she didn't warn your mom.
Oh.
She didn't tell my mother, but my mother just kind of just went, I don't know how she handled, my mother was so brilliant at handling everything, but she definitely, that one gave her a challenge, but she just did it. And she just said, you know, okay, when it was over and we were like, okay, mom, so did you know that was what we were going to go see? She says, no, but I guess if you're going to get an education, it might as well start now. So the birds and the bees was a crash course. You know, and that.
With Johnny,
so got
with
off the,
Johnny the Wad.
Oh, my Lord and Taylor. Yeah, that was a trip. But I never forgot that. Perry and I still laugh about that to this day.
V, let me ask you something. You were raised Catholic. You were a,
oh, yeah,
you were
very
a Catholic
much.
Girl. And you even served as a model for Robert Mapplethorpe.
But that, yeah, that was after I started writing. You
after
know.
You wrote. But I want to ask you about your 80-day around-the-world trip, because I love that you called it, you went with your best friend, and you called it around the world with a faggot and a slut.
Right. That's what Robert wanted to call it. He was the faggot. He was the self-proclaimed faggot. I was saying, like, well, I don't consider myself a slut, but it did have a ring to it. So in fact, we did make up T-shirts, but it didn't say faggot and slut. It said Mary and Veronica, which is my original name. So, yeah, no, that was he was from Australia, Robert, and he lived right next door, and we were best friends. I used to bring him home to New Jersey for the holidays, you know. And so then one day he said, well, you know, I've been spending Christmas with your family. Why don't you spend Christmas with mine? And I kind of laughed because they lived in Perth. So, but we took the globe down I had a globe and we took it down and we started, well, if we went on this trip, you know, where we would go? And he said, well, I want to see the boys from Ipanema. And so Rio de Janeiro was going to be the first stop. And then we knew what was called in that day a space waitress, a flight attendant who lived in South Africa. So, okay, we'll go to Johannesburg to see this one. So we plotted it, and we went to Asia, and we went to Africa, and we went to the Far East, we went to India, but we didn't go to Europe or any of those places. So, and Robert was an amateur photographer. He had a Hasselblad. So I said, oh, okay, well, I'll bring a bunch of sexy outfits, and you can photograph me in all these monuments and places all over the world. And then when we come back, I'll write the story and we'll use your photos and we'll sell it. You know, we'll make all our money back. So we took out our American Express cards. We did the trip and I didn't sell it right away, but it took maybe 2 years later when I hooked up with one of the Penthouse magazines, sold it for a six-part series, an erotic travel series. So called Around the World with Veronica Vera and used Max's photos. So that was a great experience. Yeah.
But now you married him. Tell us how this came about that you married your gay next door neighbor.
Well, okay, so we were best friends. The trip was in the early 80s, 82, 83. AIDS wasn't being talked about.
Right.
But now a few years later, it's like 85 and AIDS is all over. And Robert came, you know, was diagnosed with AIDS, and I thought, okay, you know, he was my closest male friend, and you know, and I felt like he wasn't out to his family, and I felt he was out to his siblings, but not to his parents, and I wanted him to know that I would really be there for him, and I wanted him to know he was really loved, because I feel like if people are not out to their parents, sometimes they feel that they're not lovable. So I went away, and Annie and I were going on a trip to a week art sabbatical with a famous artist named Linda Montano, whose motto is life is art. So when I got there, I had this dream about Robert, and I dreamt that he was like injured. And I told Annie and Linda about it. And at first I said, he was on his way to get radiation. Right. So I told Annie and Linda about it. And I said, you know, I want to do something to let him know I'll be there for him. And I kind of joked in the beginning. I said, oh, I think I've thought about marrying him. But after a week of studying life as art, I thought, well, why not? You know, why not get married? And I came back and I proposed to Robert. And he was kind of shocked. But he knew I was serious. He could tell I was serious right off the bat. And in the article, you'll see, I told my Club 90 sisters, and they thought, like, they couldn't believe it because, you know, because I was so sexual, and here I wanted to marry a gay man and not have who I wasn't having sex right. with. And so I said, like, listen, I'm serious, you know, I want you to be there for me.
One of the early stories when Annie said that she was thinking about being gay. And I remember saying, oh, my God, like, you don't have enough problems to deal with. Now you're going to be gay, too.
Yeah, throw that in the mix.
Look what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting.
Those days also, you know, there were lots of wonderful orgies that, you know, we could have with gay men. Annie and I would go to orgies with gay men. We were like best friends before Club 90. That's how Annie was my guide into the world of sex. So I was very lucky with that. So, but yeah, it was days, you know, when it was very experimental, you know, gay men, women,
even straight men. I mean, what do they say that they're only about two beers away from a blowjob
or one of these drinks that you made today.
So, I mean, and you know, and when you talk about sex, it really isn't about sex. It's really about, I think what separates us as gay men, especially, it's what completes us in our, and what we fall in love, who we fall in love with. Physically, we have the mechanics for either. And that doesn't define us because we've slept with a woman or had experience with a woman. Or if we're straight, we had an experience with a man in college or otherwise, or women with women. And there are a lot more women that are susceptible to that because their emotions are what predict their sexuality, what makes that so rewarding for them. Do you know what I mean? That's why when women, even if they just have an attraction, it's so much different. With men, we have to always fight like, oh, no, I can't think he's attractive. God, what am I, a fag? Am I a sissy? You know, I mean, it's a whole ego thing where women don't have that. I think there was an old saying that women fall in love with their ears, men fall in love with their eyes. You know, mm-hmm. So it's what we see that all of a sudden attracts us and makes us interested. And what women hear and feel is what, you know, and if you think about the physicality of it, the men are built from the outside in. So we have something that's always susceptible to movement and you know what I mean?
Swing it.
And then women are built from the inside out. So when they're experiencing, you know, romance and touch and affection and attention, then they respond from the inside out. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so if we just think about it like that, we'd much be a lot healthier when it came to sex and judgment and all the other stuff that we get so bogged down with, well, other people get bogged down with, and make it what it really isn't. It's just a human experience and a physical one, and we're all entitled to it. So,
and why do you have to choose? Why can't you enjoy
no
both?
Choice. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, V is the actual queen of this. V knows all about that. Gender's on a sliding scale because as a female, I know I have hugely male tendencies, and there are a lot of males I know that have very female tendencies, and sure. We're all on a sliding scale.
Exactly. I thought, Joe, I was not going to get interrupt you, but I thought, oh wow, this is like. Lots of debate here could be happening with everything.
Don't you have a doctorate in this?
Yeah, well, we all have doctorates, actually. Annie has the PhD, but all of us Club 90s are doctors of human sexuality. Yeah, I've got the plaque on my wall.
Yeah. But Veronica, how long has it been since you've had Miss Vera's Academy for Boys?
Miss Vera's Finishing School.
Yeah, I was going to go there. So you might as well tell us about it. Tell us about this finishing school and what it's called.
Okay, well, it's called Miss Vera's Finishing School for Boys Who Want to Be Girls. And I began it in like 1989, 1990. That was my first
student. Way ahead of the trend.
Yeah, and that was a time when there were a lot of changes in Club 90, too, when we kind of scattered a bit. We were already scattering. And now I've had the school. It's all men, people who've been raised as men, but feel very strongly there's a woman inside. So these were people who at that time would be called cross-dressers or transvestites. Right. And, you know, but I, because of everything I learned exploring my own sexuality and being a part of Club 90 and interviewing people, you know, writing all those articles about sex, I really believe, you know, we all have a right to be who we are as humans, as human beings, as long as we respect the rights of others. So I started this school and I placed an ad. I had met someone who was helping cross-dressers with their hair and makeup. That's how it kind of began. She introduced me to my first student. And I started at that time, at the end of the 80s, to write a memoir about what I had learned in the sex biz. And I thought, oh, well, how can I, you know, make money in a way that doesn't affect my writing, you know, not writing columns. And I thought, well, all right, I'll advertise this cross-dressing business. And so I did it in a very classy way because I knew I was bringing something very closeted out into the open. So I created great brochures. And the name, you know, I was really grateful to come up with the name because it was very out there. And then people in the 30 years have been coming from across, not only across the country, but from around the world. So, and these are all, you know, people who... some will transition, some have transitioned. Most are living in both lives. They're living lives as men and they're living lives as women. And so,
but many of them are straight men, correct? COVID,
many are straight. What? And married too.
Many are married, but I always said the line between who's straight, who's gay is a very blurry line, especially when you start playing with gender. When I began the school, this goes along with what you're saying, you said, Joe. When I began the school, I thought, oh, these people just want to get penetrated. They just want something up the butt. That's what they feel the experience of being female is. But I learned that it's so much more than that.
Yeah. And you all considered yourself feminists, right? At the back, you really felt that this was empowering and you were going to get better pay and you were working for women's rights, but you were battling the other feminists who thought that this industry was really anti-women. And Robin, maybe a lot of people will place your mother, if I say your mom became the publisher of
High Society.
I was gonna say Hustler. Yeah. High Society.
No, that'd be Larry. Our good friend Larry Flint. Yeah, so she was, you know, they called her, you know, there was Hefner in the 50s, and then there was, you know, Guccione, and then there was my mother, and she really started something that no other woman had done before, and that was to helm a men's, what they would call a men's sophisticated magazine, which was on par with Penthouse and Playboy. But she was not just a figurehead. She did everything in that at that magazine, from selecting, you know, the girls. She wrote all of the letters to the editor. You know, she was great wit, great sense of timing.
Yeah.
So she wasn't just like a pretty chick with, you know, big boobs that hung around. She did that too. She wore all those hats.
Yeah.
Really well. So she was often really singled out by the Women Against Pornography because she was such a great spokesperson, and she was the antithesis of the vapid, what everyone's image of a, you know, a floozy, oh, porn star. Well, she was nothing like that.
Nothing like that. She was extremely ambitious, really smart. You know,
she was Mensa, baby. Right, she was Mensa, and she could hold her own and hold court with just about any echelon, everybody. And so consequently, she was, you know, a lot of people were attracted to her in the media because she was well-spoken and she could handle her own and actually have a debate where she wasn't defensive, you know,
or intimidated. She wasn't intimidated. Yes. Yeah.
Right. So
she would always say sex is the great leveler.
Yeah.
You know,
But Robin, the whole thing is she made a big living going on the road, having debates with the anti-porn people. Do you remember that, Robin? She did that.
Yeah, she was with a college lecture bureau, And as she was phasing out of publishing, and she, you know, she appeared in over 30 X-rated films, but then also on every major TV show from Oprah to, you know, to Tom Snyder and everyone in between.
Yeah.
But then she went on the college lecture circuit debating in colleges with women against pornography. And it was unusual because there were certain times where, you know, after this debate, the anti-porn gal would like come over and say like, you know, like, I kind of get what you're saying. And even though I'm the, you know, the spokesperson for this industry that is, you know, against what you're saying, I can relate. And so I think my mother took great pleasure in that.
I think your mom went to lunch with her a couple of times, didn't she? I think mm-hmm. she went out. It wasn't, it was what they, their debate was what, like their jobs. It was like two lawyers debating
right.
each other, and they were friends mm-hmm. outside of the debate. I thought that was awesome.
This is perfect lead into the last thing I want to ask you. And V, it kind of falls on you, but there was a U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee or subcommittee on juvenile justice, and they held hearings on porn. First of all, I want to know, why is the Juvenile Justice Committee having a hearing on porn? I was kind of struck by that. I didn't quite understand. Sounds like a bunch of dirty old senators wanting to hear porn stories.
Well, I'm not sure why it became under that committee. I guess they wanted to have the start, you know, have the committee, and it's like, oh, well, where can we fit it in? Yeah. So it was Arlen Specter, and actually Gloria was supposed to be the one who would be one of the people to testify, but she was having back surgery. So she asked me if I would do it, and I was thrilled to do it. I thought, oh yeah, okay. So I was all prepared. Now, Al Gold, I was all prepared to, you know, write up all this philosophy, and Al Goldstein said, you know, be careful, you know, these are, you know, these are serious people. So he sent me to his lawyer, a guy named Ken Norwick, who was an ACLU attorney. And Ken looked at what I had written up and he said, oh, forget all this philosophy. He said, they want to know what your experiences were. So I changed what I was going to write. And I just, you know, went and Annie was going to come with me because we document everything, you know, we ladies like to document everything.
Long before Instagram and the selfie, where it was a disposable camera if you were, you know, lucky, or if you had that, the Nikon.
Right.
So we went together, and also my editor from Adam, the magazine I wrote for a dozen years, he happened to be in town. So I said, well, you come with us, you know, so he came. And and Seika testified that day. So the day we testified, it was not only me, it was Seika and I were testifying together. Al Goldstein testified earlier that day. Then there was John Money, who was a pioneering sex change doctor who got in a lot of trouble later, but he did pioneering work. And then John Weston, the Adult Film Association. So I think that was all of us, were five of us. So that was it. And then later my testimony became part of that testimony was October 84. Then January of 85, they started the Meese hearings, which is what they really wanted to do. They really wanted to, like, say, to me, having hearings like that is like distracting the public. So to make people feel guilty about their sexuality so that politicians or whatever, they can, you know, rape the country in other ways. So January of 85, the Meese hearing started, and my testimony, the testimony that that we did that day became part of the Meese hearings. But I got to also, you know, they asked for evidence. So I had modeled for like some bondage photos, and I thought, well, I know this is what Dworkin and McKinnon, the big anti-porn crusaders, are complaining about. So I sent them this photo series of me in bondage.
And he held up. He opened the magazine, the senator.
Yes.
And he showed these bondage photos of you. And
which Annie was the photographer, actually.
Okay. And asked why you had posed for them. And then you said exactly. You would read a paragraph explaining why you would explore this bondage fantasy. Do you remember what you said?
You have to log on to narratively.com to read it.
Yes, that's right.
You don't want to give it all away, do you
mean? Make them, yeah, right.
Well, and we're not going to talk about that with that kind of language on this podcast anyway.
And I, you know, there were all TV cameras around, so I asked permission. So now you can find the rest at Narratively.
The best part is in the Congressional Record what you said.
Big word that she had to say that they let her say. It was.
Exactly.
Well, yeah, I kept thinking like, okay, what are those seven dirty words we're not able to say on TV, mm-hmm, yeah, you know?
Shit, so. Fuck, cunt, cocksucker, motherfucker, and tits.
And so it was one of those.
Yes, it was one of those.
Wow.
Things have changed. There is one thing I'd like to get your opinion on, and one thing that troubles me and it angers me terribly is that there's all this hypocrisy and how everything sex all of a sudden now makes us perverted and it has to do with children. How does that sick mind add that to the mix? If we're gay, if we're a transsexual, if we're a drag queen, all of a sudden now we're doing something to children. Isn't that your parents' job to be able to teach them and to protect them and to let them understand? One thing has nothing to do with the other.
Did you see the cartoon with the priest and the clergyman? And it says, you know, the men in dresses who are abusing our children, you know, right, are not wearing high heels or something like that.
You've opened a big can of worms because I've always thought about this. There's, if you look throughout the ages, the things that have been not passed in society, such as homosexuality, such as dressing up in drag and stuff like that, now they're all accepted. And the only one major thing that is not accepted, and believe me, I'm not promoting it should be accepted, but is about sex with children. So the only way they can try and drag you back into the dark ages is by attaching you to that.
To that.
That thing, which, yes, the only sexual preference, I mean, except for necrophilia, that's not been accepted. An intelligent, you know, society that allows people to have their different preferences and everything. That's the only, it's kind of like the last taboo. So if you connect whatever sexuality with that last taboo, you know, you're scaring people, which is all their tactic is.
Yeah,
it's
and
all
to
about
control, of course.
But nobody's closer to this than your children.
And you know what? I made it a huge point. Never to be inappropriate with them or being, you know, you just, that was such a big thing that I stayed away from for, you know, so long. I never, you know, I made sure I never went out with their friends, you know, when they're of an age or something like that. I never, I'm serious. You know, that whole thing about, you know, the mom that's, you know, getting her son's, you know, best friend or something like that. Never, 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 because I never wanted to associated with that. Yeah.
Well, you never blurred the lines. I mean, because what you do, you know, there's an old saying, it's not what you do, but how you do. And the mm-hmm. fact that you are a mother and how you are as a mother is what's important. There are a lot of parents that are terrible parents and terrible human beings. Mm-hmm. And that, mm-hmm. and they may have these upstanding careers or positions in politics or in life or wherever, however you want to do it, but they're not those people. And this is just an example of what you see is not always what you get, and what you don't see may be even better yet. So,
so much hypocrisy, so much hypocrisy,
of course, so much
society, yeah. You know, and always deflecting to the underdog to hide what they're doing. And, you know, that's one thing I always give my mother so much credit for is that when I was 12 years old, she was 35 and decided, you know, that she was going to make an X-rated film after much deliberation. And she came to me. And I really respect her for that because she was always honest from mm-hmm. the very beginning. You know, if she had tried to hide it from me, and, you know, and then I see her poster 50 feet Times Square, that would have been devastating, you know, but mortified. But my whole life, she always was very open and honest. And I give her great kudos
yeah.
for that because that really kind of set the stage. And, you know, a lot of people had this fantasy that, you know, she lied around in bed all day, you know, eating bonbons while a bevy of boys came through. But she was a Jewish mother. She just happened to also be a porn star. So that fantasy that people have about the lifestyles that porn stars live when they're not in front of the camera is often anything but what's really happening.
I mean, let's face it, we all work and we all do check in and we check out. So I don't know anybody that works 24/7. You know what I mean? We all have careers. We all have lifestyles. We also have things that we believe in, and we also have, you know, responsibilities to ourselves, to our children, to our family, to our work, to life, and to every day, and to whoever we perceive as God. And it really has nothing to do with anybody else, what they want to throw on us, because that just doesn't stick, and it's not, and it shouldn't. So,
ladies, thank you. Thank you so much.
I'll drink a porn star to that, too.
You have your beer. You have your coffee. Read the article in narratively.com. It's very good. It's very interesting. It goes way beyond what we've talked about. And thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Well, you know, I was very pleased to speak with them. I thought they were interesting. They were intelligent. They were articulate. You know, and I think The three that we spoke to, at least two of them have PhDs.
All of them have PhDs. All of them do. In human sexuality.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah. And Robin, by the way, is a major real estate realtor.
Yeah.
And of
They're
course,
all professionals,
Annie, who wasn't on with
children.
Us. They have children, except for Annie, because she's now living with a woman.
Yeah.
And they're all very, very accomplished in what they're doing and very bright. And I thought they were great. And the reason, you know, that we had them on was to show that all of our ideas of who people are and what things are not the same as
our impressions are. You know, we have to look a lot deeper than we do and listen more intently, because all of a sudden you find out, wow, I'm learning something from this person. And I actually even like this person.
Yeah. No, exactly. And I haven't dealt with the others as long as I've dealt with Robin. I've been dealing with Robin for, you know, a couple of years, and she's really, really smart. Mm-hmm. I mean, the things that she sends me and that she does and says, and, you know, even on contracts and things, these are very bright women.
Yeah.
And, you know, all the more power to them, because they did something in an industry where people think they're not bright. And here they were, you know, controlling their lives. At least they were in their 20s doing what they felt at the time. And then they turned around and made, you know, something out of their lives beyond
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. And let me ask you this question when you said that. So because they were in the porn business, which basically they're having sex or performing some sort of a sexual act.
As I said in the interview, I don't, porn is sort of the wrong word, because porn is short for pornography, and which is sort of a negative term.
Right. Well, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. So all of a sudden, they're bright, they're smart, they're all of the things, they're mothers, they're all of these things, great things. And then once you hear that they're having sex for, you know, in front of a camera or whatever,
right,
that all of a sudden, that's all you think about. You don't realize the person behind all of that, and or that they're not intelligent or whatever. You know, it takes a lot of smarts to be good in bed.
Well, not only that, they're acting for sure, because if you read the article, you know, her mother was like, oh, I had to smoke a joint plenty of times before I did this so I could get my head wrapped
around. You had to be smart to know you had to do that.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, they're not necessarily attracted to these people that they're paired with.
It's a like you said, it's a role.
Yeah. You know. So, you know, they're doing it for money. They were young. You know, it's worth looking at their pictures when they're young. They were beautiful.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was easy money for them, and they did it, and they got involved with it, and they rather liked it. And, you know, off they went.
No, it's kind of funny. They should read that article, because you'll see the pictures from them before and now. So it's almost like the Golden Girls meet.
Yeah. It's the, you know? The article is absolutely worth reading, which is why we did this. Yes. So the article was released a couple of days ago.
Yeah, you'll really enjoy this article. They're very interesting, and they're lively and quite intelligent, and some great stories. I mean, interesting stories.
Yeah, that was fun. It was a good one.
Yep.
It's always nice to speak to intelligent people.
Yeah,
And you know what we don't normally do, which we get to do this week, is next week we have on Randall Kleiser, the director.
Yes, that's a great interview.
We never promo our next things, and you know, we've already spoken to him and seen him, and so that'll be our next podcast.
Yeah, listen out for that. You'll enjoy it.
Yeah. So thank you.
Until then,
we'll talk at you soon. This podcast is a production of the Villa Romana Network in association with Spotify.